From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. No more bullying, the Bible and the box office, and the lessons of Salem. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you. Please visit us online, stateofbelief.com, and help keep this show on the air. Saturday, the 12th, marks Lazarus Sunday for followers of the Orthodox Christian tradition. Sunday the 13th is Palm Sunday, the beginning of Holy Week in Christianity. Monday marks the Baisakhi New Year for Sikhs, and Tuesday at sundown, the Jewish observance of Passover begins. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Tell us, are you the Son of God? I am.
One of the numerous religiously themed movies we're seeing lately is Son of God, an epic retelling of the life of Jesus Christ. The Right Reverend Gene Robinson, retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, is both a film buff and an insightful observer of our culture, and Gene will be with us in the studio to talk about this film in particular and about this whole trend of religious movies in general.
I thought you said she was dead.
That was her sister, the Wicked Witch of the East. This is the Wicked Witch of the West. She's worse than the other one.
The roughly five-year period beginning in 1688 that encompasses the events surrounding the Salem witch trials has given us a powerful and durable metaphor. Reading Marilyn Roach's new book, Six Women of Salem, does much more than that. It personalizes both the victims and the perpetrators of this shameful history, and in so doing underscores how human nature really has not changed much during the intervening centuries. On this week's show, you'll meet the author, Marilyn K. Roach. But first,
students to express their views on religion and politics and other subjects without fear of being labeled as bullies or being punished under a oppressive anti-bullying policy that violates their rights.
GLSEN is behind a lot of the thinking here, the gay, lesbian, straight,
transgender kids and homosexual kids, if there is such a thing.
Keep your children home from school that day. Some schools allow student organizers to widely promote the Day of Silence and homosexuality while recruiting others to participate.
One of the darkest corners of the supposedly faith-based anti-gay industry in this country contains bloggers and public figures who angrily oppose any protections for kids who are or even perceived to be LGBTQ. Sometimes these opponents hijack the language of religious liberty, insisting that children from fundamentalist families have the absolute right to speak out against their classmates on religious freedom grounds, and that anti-bullying initiatives trample this supposed freedom. Sometimes the complaint is that mere awareness of the existence of differently oriented students somehow deprives conservatives' kids of their innocence. Well, regardless of the rhetoric, this is all happening in the name of morality. But conservatives don't hold a monopoly on morality. In fact, there are many, many of us who believe that it is precisely because of our morality that we must work to protect kids from bias and bullying. Even as this past Friday, LGBTQ students and their allies across the nation took part in the National Day of Silence to oppose harassment and discrimination. Faith groups are advocating for legislation to increase needed protections. A prominent among these groups is Keshet, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Executive Director Edith Klein. Edith, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much.
There are two pieces of legislation that activists are pushing for. Please start by describing those bills, if you will.
The two bills that are currently under consideration in the legislature are the Safe Schools Improvement Act and the Student Non-Discrimination Act, which are similar but have some critical differences, and together would really bolster the protections that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender students and students who are perceived as LGBT experience in their daily lives in schools. The Safe Schools Improvement Act would prohibit bullying and harassment according to many different identity categories, including sexual orientation and gender identity, as well as religion. And the Student Non-Discrimination Act would specifically prohibit public schools from discriminating against any student because of their real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. So one is about prohibiting discrimination, and the other specifically identifies bullying and harassment as what would be marked as simply unacceptable in elementary or secondary school settings.
Now, your organization has sent a letter of support for this legislation to members of Congress. Why was it important for your organization to do that?
So as an organization whose mission is to work for the full equality and inclusion of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Jews in Jewish life, we see working for equality as Jews in the broader world as an essential aspect of that mission. Much of the work that we do within the Jewish community is with institutions that work with youth, so synagogues, Jewish day schools, summer camps, youth movements. And so we see every day in our own Jewish community the challenges that kids and others experience because of their real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity, and the challenges that educators and rabbis and others in positions of authority in the Jewish community experience in struggling to create safe and affirming spaces for kids. And so we see our role as both about creating a different kind of climate with policies that provide protection within the Jewish world and urging members of the Jewish community as Jews, because of our historic commitment to justice, to work for justice in the broader world. And in this case, one manifestation of that would be the passage of these two pieces of legislation that would provide protection for LGBT students.
Do you have any idea of the timeline on this for possible action on Capitol Hill?
It's really hard to say. Obviously, there hasn't been much moving quickly through the House for quite a while. So, I mean, these are pieces of legislation that have been in process for a long time. And like a lot of LGBT rights legislation, such as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, there are moments of hope and moments of hope being dimmed. Certainly, I think in some aspects of LGBT life, change has happened at a much more rapid pace than any of us would have thought possible. So I'm hopeful that things will accelerate in this regard. We have co-sponsors in both the House and the Senate, but not enough to ensure passage at this point.
What do you say to opponents of student protection legislation, those who consider anti-gay bullying to be a form of religious expression?
I say that in no religion that I've ever heard of have I seen mistreatment of others, dishonoring others, disrespecting others valid as a form of religious expression. Mm-hmm. That in every religion that I know of, protecting human dignity, treating each person the way you would want to be treated, seeing each person as created in the divine image, these are all central tenets to certainly the religions of the majority of those who live in this country and the religions that are generally called upon in such arguments.
I am concerned enough and I guess angered enough by the fact that some religions would encourage their young people to do this. That gives them the mentality, I guess, for anti-gay bullying. But I'm even more angered by the fact that they tell them to take pride in this, that it's a way of sharing their faith. I just don't get that.
Yeah, it's very troubling. And, and so for that reason and others, it's wonderful to see the growth of things like the National Day of Silence or student participation in celebrating Pride in the spring or National Coming Out Day in the fall, to see students and their schools and their parents and the broader community affirm this commitment to creating communities where people of all identities feel like there is a place for them.
Yeah. Are you seeing any shift in the way progressive faith communities are making the connection between their moral convictions and public action? Because for years, it seemed like the language of values was monopolized by conservatives, and that seems to be changing, but I'm interested in your view.
I do think there's a shift. I think that we're much more seeing progressive people of faith, people who may in the past not necessarily have thought of themselves as people of faith, seeing that there is a tremendous amount of resource in their tradition that affirms their political positions and helps deepen them and ground them. Here at Keshet, as an organization that works in the Jewish community, these issues are particularly resonant now, just a couple of days before we begin the celebration of Passover, which for us is the time when we celebrate our liberation as a people from slavery and also reflect on ways in which we and others still experience oppression and think about our responsibility to work for a better world. Mm-hmm. So it's very resonant to think about the National Day of Silence that just happened and what's represented by that collective act of silence that symbolically represents the silencing of students who experience anti-LGBT bullying, you know, and then to think about what real liberation means. Mm-hmm. So that's just one of the ways that I, for instance, find resonance and application, you know, in my own religious tradition for a political reality that exists today. And I do see that happening more and more, and people, thankfully, refusing to cede that ground to the religious right.
Edith, if you would, talk about some of the other initiatives at Keshet that listeners should know about. And also, I would like for you to give them your website address so that they can keep up with you that way, too.
So our website is www.keshetonline.org, K-E-S-H-E-T, online.org. And our mission is about working for a Jewish world where there is full equality and inclusion for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Jews. And we do that by working for change within Jewish institutions like synagogues, Hebrew schools, summer camps, youth movements, Jewish community centers, offering training and consultation for staff and community members, offering resources. We also do leadership development work directly with LGBTQ teens, providing them with places of support where they can find a place where they can be whole and be their full selves and also gain the resources to go back and create change in their home communities. And finally, one of our newer projects is a national organizing project that calls upon parents of LGBTQ Jews to take action as parents with all of the ferocious commitment to a better world for their kids that parents uniquely have.
Edith Klein is Executive Director of Keshet, a national grassroots organization that works for the full equality and inclusion of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Jews in Jewish life. This group has sent a letter to members of Congress urging action on the Safe Schools Improvement Act and the Student Non-Discrimination Act. Edith, I want to thank you for being willing to take some time and share information about that work with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
I know I'm far from alone in considering the Right Reverend Gene Robinson a hero of human rights. As the first openly gay bishop installed in the Episcopal Church, he served as both a role model and a leader in the movement for inclusion and celebration of LGBT people in that denomination and far, far beyond that. Busy as ever since his retirement as Bishop of New Hampshire last year, Gene includes a fellowship at the Center for American Progress among his important commitments. because he's also a keen observer of our culture and society today, I wanted to get his thoughts on what appears to be a boom in Bible-themed motion pictures. And I'm very happy when Gene Robinson is in this studio, and he is today. And, Gene, I'm delighted to see you again on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's always a pleasure to be with you, and I'm just delighted to be here.
Good. You know, across the years, we've talked about some weighty issues on this show. Today's topic may be a bit lighter, but that doesn't mean that it is insignificant. Do you think we're seeing enough religion theme films lately that we would call it a trend, or is it a cycle, or what is it?
It does seem to me to be somewhat of a cycle. You know, we had some movies in the recent past, Mel Gibson's film, of course, that just made a gazillion dollars. And I think anytime anybody wants to make some money, they know that there is a religious audience out there. And interestingly, this new movie, Son of God, is being promoted not in a traditional sense, but through churches and congregations and various and sundry religious groups. So I do think that we are seeing a resurgence. And of course, the movie Noah has just come out, which I've not seen. But, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about this round of films is that they are very, very well made. I mean, the visuals are quite dramatic. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're probably seeing a better round of religious films than we're used to seeing in the past.
I interviewed the writer of Noah last week, one of the writers of Noah. And he's getting a lot of criticism because it isn't biblical enough. And then he's getting a lot of criticism because it's too biblical.
Well, that's probably a pretty good sign for him then. It sounds like he came down kind of in the right place.
Yeah, yeah. In this age of social media and endless entertainment choices, do Hollywood movies have the same ability to move culture that they once did?
Maybe even more so. I think our modern social culture is a bit on the lazy side. And so if you can sit down for a couple of hours and get the sweep of scripture, that's a lot easier than actually digging into it. And I guess what I would say about all these movies is I like the book better. You know, you can't go wrong with the scriptures itself. Yeah. But as movies over the past several decades can show, you can go wrong with movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cecil B. DeMille shaped my early theology.
Mine too. You know, those images are still with me along with the picture books that I had in Sunday school, you know, growing up. And I don't care how sophisticated you get in your theology, those images still come back.
Yeah, they do. They do. Well, some films, like Son of God or the movie that was shown at CPAC, Persecuted, are promoted in conservative religious communities, as you've already mentioned. Churchgoers are asked to commit to see the movie, to help pay for the distribution of the movie. Noah was a different matter, but this was a bona fide hit. So tell me, Gene, is this outreach to churches evangelical or economical?
Well, you could never take the economics out of it, right? I mean, there's just too much money involved. On the other hand, I do think that at their best, these movies are trying to communicate images and stories that are central to the faith. I mean, the difference, I think, between Noah and Son of God is that you've got a rather sparse story with Noah. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot more leeway to fill in the gaps. And most stories of the life of Jesus have followed a very linear approach. Several of them have committed themselves to only having Jesus say what we have a record of Jesus saying in Scripture. This latest one, Son of God, fills in a lot more of the gaps and I think is very, very interesting in doing so. The danger there, of course, is whoever's doing the writing is doing the filling in of the gaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, whether the viewing public will in their minds think they heard those things in Scripture or not, I don't know. Depends, I guess, on how well they know their Bibles.
Yeah.
And some of it is actually quite winning. I think my favorite scene in Son of God is Jesus is in a boat with Peter fishing. This is when he calls Peter to be his follower, mm-hmm. which, as I recall in Scripture, Jesus is not in the boat but on the shore. Yeah. But there are three lines that I just love. So Jesus says to Peter, I'm giving you the chance to change your life. And Peter says, what are we going to do? And Jesus says, change the world. Now, that is not in Scripture,
no.
But I think it does capture the kind of curiosity that these men who were called to be disciples must have felt. You know, they must have had this sense of being with someone who was really quite out of the ordinary and quite forward-thinking and adventurous and risk-taking, because there had to be something in the person of Jesus that made them want to drop everything and follow him. And I thought that little dialogue that was clearly just made up by a writer captured some of what we don't know about the decision-making for Peter and the other disciples.
I'm thinking about the power behind storytelling through film. And depending on how a story is told, it can influence someone. Like we said, Cecil B. DeMille had influenced us and all of those images. What's the best movie you ever saw?
My favorite movie in the whole world is Shawshank Redemption.
Mm. And why?
I think it was a Jesus story. So, I'm a sap for Jesus stories because that's what my life is all about. Mm. Redemption is in the title and redemption is in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with a sort of an anti-hero at the helm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very unlikely hero who suffers greatly and overcomes the evil that affects him. I just think it's an incredibly powerful story about the human spirit and is a reflection of the kind of story that we see in the life of Jesus.
I was going to say, am I wrong in saying that the best religious movies, the best biblical movies I've ever seen were not about the Bible or about a Bible story?
I just couldn't agree more. That is so true. And part of the reason, I think, is let's remember that the Jesus event was a lot more than we have descriptions of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so every time you try to make a biblical movie, let's say about the life of Jesus, you're stuck with sticking to the text itself, or you're on your own and you're making stuff up as you go along. And neither actually gets at the reality of whatever that Jesus event was.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you take a mystery and you try to make it concrete, you limit the mystery.
Yeah.
And so I think ultimately these biblical movies are doomed to fail, at least as far as, let's say, capturing the historical Jesus.
Right.
That has been the quest of humankind ever since Jesus was here 2,000 years ago. And every time you try to take that mystery, which has been communicated to us not just by Scripture but by countless generations of Christians telling that story, every time you try to tie it down, you diminish it.
Yeah.
And so I think in some ways non-religious movies can be a greater reflection of that mystery than some depiction of the events that are recorded in the Bible.
If you were going to use a Bible story to make a big budget Hollywood movie, what story would you tell?
Well, so the one I would long to tell is my favorite story in all of Scripture. It only occurs in one of the Gospels. Thank goodness for the Gospel of Luke. It's the story of the prodigal son. And this is one of those stories, of course, that happens in all kinds of movies, right? I mean, we see it reflected in all kinds of ways. One of my favorite ballets is The Prodigal Son. And I saw Edward Villella dance it with the New York City Ballet once. And I'll never forget the ending of this, you know, this magnificent specimen of humankind, Edward Villella, mm-hmm. at the end of this, is standing or crawling really to his father, who was there with outstretched arms and robes covering him. And Villela literally crawls up his father's body and puts his arms around his neck and goes into a fetal position. And the father just envelops him in his robes until he completely disappears. Mm. Now, that's the coming home that I think we all long for in our belief in God, however described, however imaged in our worship and so on. So that's the story I love to see on film and non-religious mm-hmm. films. And I think it's fruitful enough that someone could do something with it.
Yeah.
In fact, if you just want to give me $20, $30 million, I'd be willing to give it a try.
Let me check my bank book. We've got a – Gene, when we spoke right before your retirement, you were talking about your plans for peacemaking and activism here in Washington. Can I ask you to update us on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm loving Washington, D.C., notwithstanding the Congress, which is driving us all crazy. I love the city for its openness, not just of its architecture. You know, we have a height restriction here in Washington, which gives the city a kind of manageable scale that I think most of our cities with skyscrapers don't have. I'm loving my work at the Center for American Progress. There are just some incredibly smart people doing important work here, and to keep up with them, I have to row pretty hard, and I love that. Yeah. Also, I think the thing that I'm finding exciting is that in the fairly recent past, we've all been siloed into our own areas of concern and activity, and here at the Center for American Progress, as well, I think, in the culture, we are seeing intersectionality as the real foundation of our moving forward, so that we're beginning to see the connections with all kinds of oppression. The oppression may be different, but the dynamics of oppression and indeed trying to diminish that oppression are very, very similar. So we're seeing ethnic and racial groups and sexual orientation groups and immigration groups and all kinds of people beginning to work together in ways that I think are quite remarkable. And a great example of that was when the people were fasting for immigration reform on the Mall here in Washington. I was astounded by the number of sort of issue groups that ostensibly aren't related to immigration at all, who showed up to support and to join the fast and so on. So that kind of interdisciplinary, intersectional work is just very, very exciting to me.
Getting back to the film Son of God, I know you spent a lot of time looking at it, thinking about it. Is there in that film points that touch the realities that we face in our society and give its viewers hope that there is help from beyond for this mess we're in?
I had a number of disappointments with the film.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. I guess it's just Hollywood, right? At some point, I would like to see a reasonably unattractive Jesus. You know, having a young, handsome hottie playing Jesus is just Hollywood's way, right? But at least in this film, biblical Palestine was a dirty place, and I like that kind of realism, which I haven't seen since The Last Temptation of Christ, which was kind of a silly movie in some ways, but at least it was earthy and real. One of my disappointments in this film is you see almost no portrayal of Jesus reaching out to the poor, the dispossessed, the marginalized. Almost none of the miracles are there. You don't hear Jesus telling the stories for which he was known far and wide, and stories which are told to this day with great power. So it focuses more on the events of his life, and as is often the case, the Via Dolorosa, the Way of the Cross, is quite long and extended and gory and violent, and it seems to me that a proper and balanced view of Jesus would have at least shown him reaching out and healing people and restoring them in both emotional and physical and as well as spiritual ways. I'm also just stunned that the Last Supper and the events and the quite remarkable conversation that Jesus has with his disciples at the Last Supper mm-hmm. plays virtually no part in this film at all, mm-hmm. which for me, where communion is so important in my own life, yeah. I cannot imagine telling the story without that part in it. Yeah. So it's mystifying in a lot of ways. It's kind of refreshing. It's not told in a linear fashion. Jesus has flashed forwards and flashed backwards. And I kept thinking some of the events I was looking for might come up in a flashback, but that didn't turn out to be the case. I think that it's interesting also that this film is called The Son of God and not The Son of Man, which was Jesus' preferred reference for himself, if he referred to himself at all. Mm-hmm. And as you well know, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you can make the case that Jesus didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. It's the old Watergate case, right? What did he know and when did he know it?
Yeah.
If you read the Gospel of John, John sort of gives it away at the very beginning. I'm going to tell you about this guy and he was God and I'm going to prove it to you. But in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus is very much more struggling to figure that out the way we do,
yeah.
which is important to me because if Jesus was indeed human, then he struggled the way we do. And I take that great comfort from that. So there's nothing of that struggle in this film. And that way it's very John-like, mm-hmm. except, of course, that the greatest part of John's gospel takes place at the Last Supper. So it's this very kind of mix of being faithful to the scriptures but not portraying a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I would go as far as to say that the writer of the Gospel of Luke would not have recognized this Jesus because, of course, Luke was written for outsiders sure. and has all of those wonderful stories about Jesus reaching out to the marginalized, and they're almost absent in this film. That all being said, I enjoyed it. I once, when I was a seminarian working with a youth group, put together a slideshow of maybe 50 representations of Jesus in art and encouraged the kids in my youth group to tell me what they learned about Jesus from that particular piece of art. Mm-hmm. And so I think the best way to look at these quote-unquote religious movies, especially those about the life of Jesus, is just understand that it's one person's reflections on that life. And even if we put all those movies and all those reflections together, we still wouldn't be back to that event itself
yeah.
that did change the world.
We're headed toward Easter, the Christian festival. What's the message you want people to hear this year about Easter?
I think, especially perhaps here in America, we are proceeding along the lines of it's every man, woman, and child for themselves. You see that in the budgets that are being presented in Congress, in the cuts to food stamps and unemployment benefits and so on. It seems to me that the message of Easter is that God is with us, but that God demands something of us, and that we at least make a good faith effort to love others the way we love ourselves. And in that process, God will be with us no matter what, and not even death can separate us from that God.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire and a globally respected leader in the struggle for LGBT rights. He's a fellow at the Center for American Progress and a treasured friend of mine. And Gene, I'm so glad you were able to take time and be with us today here on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, and an early happy Easter.
Same to you. There's a reason Jon Stewart featured author Marilyn K. Roach as a guest on The Daily Show not long ago. Although her latest book, Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials, deals in what is rapidly becoming ancient history in reading the book, I was struck by how contemporary many of the impulses and suspicions that led to those trials and executions actually sound. With science under attack in our classrooms and our public square, with religious convictions increasingly threatening rational coexistence, there may be much in this story that is frighteningly relevant today. And that's why I am so pleased to welcome Marilyn Roach to State of Belief Radio. Marilyn, thank you.
Thank you.
You have written previously about the Salem witch trials. Mm-hmm. What made you want to focus on the personalities involved this time around?
This way, I can spend more time with an individual rather than trying to tell the whole story with a cast of thousands. And, you know, try to make them more real and not just symbols of something or, you know, paper doll cutouts of Halloween stuff. But, you know, they were real people. And there was enough information with these six anyway to fill in the story of what their lives were like before in most cases.
Tell us something about the main players in this horrific drama.
Oh, yeah. Well, the six are Rebecca Nurse, who's the oldest of them. She's married and has a large, intact family of grown children in their families. And they rally around her and support her through the whole ordeal and get neighbors to sign a petition saying that she's a good person. And it doesn't work in the end, but they stuck by her. And Bridget Bishop, on the other hand, was perhaps a more prickly character, and it didn't seem like anybody spoke up for her. She had been suspected before of witchcraft, and apparently that charge was dismissed because she was still alive 10 years later. And she, unfortunately, does not survive either. Mary English is the richest woman in Salem, married to the richest man in Salem. He's a successful merchant. And, well, they didn't stop neighbors from being suspicious, apparently. But she was quite well-educated and businesswoman in her own right, too. She and her husband are both accused and jailed, but they do escape, not to spoil the plot or anything, but they do escape and outlive the panic. And Putnam Sr. is an accuser rather than an accused. She has a couple of children who have died recently, which isn't terribly unusual with infant mortality, but she's taken it to heart and wonders if perhaps evil magic had contributed to that. For some reason, she just does not like Rebecca Nurse, and that kind of explodes badly in this year of panic. And Tituba is the slave woman belonging to Reverend Samuel Parris in Salem Village. She's always referred to as an Indian, presumably came from the Caribbean area somewhere. And she's not in a good position being a slave. She doesn't have a whole lot of resources. She is accused. She's named and has only her wits to save her. And Mary Warren, the sixth, is a hired girl whose family has been broken by illness. And she doesn't have too many prospects for the future unless she meets some up-and-coming young man who wants to marry her and does better for himself than people who aren't doing too well economically, because there are various economic problems in the region at the time.
Ms. Roach, I'm really curious about the kind of original research you were able to do. Would you mind talking a little about that process?
There's never enough papers survive when you really want to know everything that happened, but there's a lot of it for this set of trials. They're in different institutions. A lot of them are in the Massachusetts Archives and the Essex County Archives. Most of them were available in print, and more of them now, while I was working on the book, others get published. And online now, too, so you can see what the original documents look like. A little archaeology came into it because the cellar hole of the parsonage in Salem Village was excavated, and they found old pieces of pottery and glass, and, you know, tiny little minutiae, but it paints a picture of what the times were like. Just since the bicentennial of the Revolution, all sorts of local history was reexamined in different places, and for one thing, the witch trials of 92 and other periods, mm-hmm. were reexamined by scholars, taking it seriously instead of just dismissing it as nonsense. So other articles came out. Other documents in the Massachusetts archives, I tried to read everything that happened with the period, like expenses for the war that was going on with Canada and their native allies, and just bills that didn't get paid. There was another set of room and board bills for some of the prisoners in 1692, some of them accused of witchcraft and others. I mean, there were still burglars working their trade at the yes. time, too. So,
well, Ms. Roach, am I wrong in seeing this as almost a cautionary tale for today's America? I'm not talking about actual witch executions, of course, but mm-hmm. are there elements to the story that contain it safely within 17th century, or are we still seeing some of this?
Oh, well, human nature doesn't seem to change. Yes, it is cautionary, but because the circumstances are so bizarre to us that, you know, if something starts to go wrong, it's not recognized necessarily mm-hmm. until things get too far down the road of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Something was happening to make the original so-called afflicted girls appear mm-hmm. like they were having convulsions. And in some cases, I think there were actual illnesses involved, and some of it psychological. But even if something is really going wrong, it doesn't mean that the first solution to it as to what was causing it is necessarily the right one. Mm-hmm. And if people start panicking and jumping to conclusions, this is sort of, the 1692 trials are a prime example of jumping to conclusions.
Is that the main teaching about human nature coming out of Salem, or is there one that you put in italics and say, we should have learned this here?
Well, one is supposed to be able to learn from the past if you can recognize that the mm-hmm. same thing is happening in a different guise.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping to conclusions and acting on insufficient proof, I would say, is a big part of what we might be able to learn from this.
When you hear accusations of Satanism and possession today, for example, hurled at LGBT people by some religious leaders,
mm-hmm.
are there parallels we can draw?
Not to jump to conclusions or to demonize people.
Well, you know, there are parts of the world, particularly South Africa, where mm-hmm. atrocities continue to be committed in the name of battling witchcraft and demonic mm-hmm. possession. Are there lessons to be learned from Salem in combating these kinds of ongoing tragedies?
Well, I would hope so. Certainly it's well known because of the history and that got preserved in plays like Arthur Miller's Crucible, which is mm-hmm. more or less historical.
Yeah.
It's known as an example of when things went wrong. I would hope that people could examine other panics. And certainly witchcraft fears in various parts of the world are still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And people are really suffering from it. That is, those who are accused.
Mm-hmm. I know that you got really familiar with these six people.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find yourself having an affinity for any one of them?
Well, it was, yeah. Well, as I've said before, Bridget Bishop could be cranky, and I identified with that from time to time.
I wonder what writing this book did to you.
Well, it made me look at the available material differently and see it differently than I had when I was writing other uh-huh. things about the same topic. Obviously, the accused were innocent of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why the people who were accusing them thought what they thought, or in some cases, why they said things that they mm-hmm. said they thought. I wondered how convinced anybody was at any one time. I would imagine that at some point they would realize, I'm guessing, but realize that their suspicions were not founded on accurate information, mm-hmm. but that it was too difficult to retract what you'd been saying so vehemently all along. At what point did they realize it?
So what made them despise these people enough to make those charges?
It's hard to say. I don't know why Ann Putnam Sr. didn't like Rebecca Nurse so much. Mm-hmm. Whatever altercation they might have had just didn't get recorded.
Yeah. No.
In Mary Warren's case, a neighbor, Ann Parker, came over and had an argument with her parents around the time that her mother, Mary's mother, and little sister became ill with something that was real. There was smallpox in the area. It might have been that. And the mother dies, and the little sister becomes deaf because of it. And she, Mary, assumes that this is a matter of witchcraft, or she mm-hmm. convinces herself of it. So there was a good deal of family misfortune that got blamed on the neighbor that time.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn K. Roach is the author of Six Women of Salem, the untold story of the accused and their accusers in the Salem witch trials. Her 2007 book, The Salem Witch Trials, A Day-by-Day Chronicle of a Community Under Siege, is being published in paperback this summer. Marilyn, this book is a fascinating look at a time that is a lot less distant than it seemed to be and that I wish it was.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to support us today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who tell us that they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply can't find anywhere else. We want that to keep happening. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about this show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook and Twitter, or you can call our listener line, 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen right along with you and others so all of us can have a conversation over the air. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.